Hello and welcome to The Calling. We are back. I'm here once again with Marek Zabriski and Josh Barton, as well as Sherry Shapiro. And we're going to be talking, as we do on this podcast, a little bit about how people discover meaning in their lives, why they do what they do, and how they got to the place they are now. And Marek, do you want to tell us a little bit about Sherry?
I'd be glad to, Andrew. Sherry has served as executive director of Kids in Crisis for over 42 years. Under her leadership, Kids in Crisis has become a model agency for providing crisis intervention services. And we are so excited to have you with us for your first podcast. Is that right?
Absolutely. Thank you for having me.
But I hear that when you were 16, you had a TV show. Tell us about that.
I did. It was fascinating. It was actually interviewing adults, a group of teenagers, and really finding out what gave them meaning in their life. So, for example, we interviewed Father Hesburgh from Notre Dame, Roberta Flack, Bobby Dylan. It was really fascinating.
Bobby Dylan.
Exactly. Bobby Darin as well. And it was really a wonderful experience because I got to meet people and work with people from all walks of life as a 16-year-old.
Holy smokes. Those interviews, was there one that stands out specifically in your mind that you just say, wow?
You know, I think Roberta Flack just was such a caring person, as was Father Hesburgh, and sadly shortly thereafter passed away. But it was just hearing what motivated them and what moved them, and it was fascinating.
That's amazing. So here we are, all these years later. It's like would you have imagined at 16 that you would be sitting here talking on the other end?
No, not at all. I don't know what I thought at 16 about now.
None of us do.
I thought whatever age I'm at now was old when I was 16.
So when you look back, was there a moment you recall that changed the course of your life that put you on the trajectory of where you are today?
You know, when I was young, my dad had become very ill, and I saw how people reached out. And I never really thought about that question until I got this email asking it. And I think that was really a moving part for me because I was devastated as a high school kid to be going through this experience and not knowing what was going to happen. And yet the kindness of strangers and people wanting to help us as strangers made me realize what a small world we're in, and that we can touch somebody else's life without knowing who they are.
That's really incredible. How old were you when that kind of went down?
That was in my high school years.
Wow. That's tough. That's a lot to carry. And so was there any other kind of stuff that happened as like post those high school years, would you say, that kind of impacted like where you are today and what you're doing that kind of influenced you to get into this particular field?
You know, I think we kind of arrive where we are because somebody's looking over us. Mm-hmm. So I don't know exactly where I took right turns and left turns. But I know that in 1980, I landed back in Connecticut, which is where I was born and raised, and landed at what was then the Greenwich Youth Shelter. And I've grown up there. My kids have grown up there. And now I'm blessed with my grandkids knowing what it's like to be a part of something that makes a difference in people's lives.
Oh, that's great.
How did you get involved in Kids in Crisis, and what was it like back then?
It was small. It was a very different world back in 1980 than it is today in 2022. You know, we saw 125 kids at that point, and today we see 6,000 or 7,000 kids that we're impacting. But kids are kids, and I've always been humbled that they allow us into their lives, that they allow us to become a part of what is happening to them, and they trust us, and they believe that we can walk side by side with them and make a difference.
That's great. So, Sherry, just for the listeners that may not be informed on the mission of Kids in Crisis. Can you give us a little kind of a little summary of what is the mission?
Sure. Our mission is really to make sure that kids are safe at home, whatever home means to them at that moment. So we work with kids who are runaway. We work with kids who are abused or neglected or homeless. We work with kids struggling with relationships with their families, parents, siblings. And our goal is to get them connected to services that are going to keep that family together as much as possible. And when they can't stay together, recognize that not being together is also the right thing and finding the right alternative for them.
Hmm. That's and so then how do kids, because I can imagine, you know, if a 12 or 13 or whatever age year old is in need of help, that they may not know or how to reach out, how to get help. So how are you and Kids in Crisis, how are you introduced to these kids? How are they finding their way to you?
It's a great question. And podcasts like this are really critical to us getting the word out, because I don't think people don't always know when they're in crisis. They don't know when they need to reach out. I think the pandemic has helped in some ways because it has normalized reaching out. Mm-hmm. When we were all isolated, there was nothing we could do but reach out because we were all in. And so getting the word out is key. We have staff that work in schools, at the Boys and Girls Club. We do events throughout the community, but getting to where parents are as well, for parents to know that they can reach out when they're at wit's end, when things at home are ready to explode or implode and they need help. Asking for help is okay, and we do it 24/7. We have staff that answer our hotline 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. We have 20 beds for kids who cannot stay at home right away with the goal to return them home. We have programs for kids in elementary schools. We have LGBTQ programs. We have programs for parents to learn how to work better with their kids, anti-bullying programs, and emergency services.
So what are, you're seeing a huge spectrum of issues, I'm sure. What are some of the more common ones? And would you say what you see are mostly long-term situations or short-term?
That's a great question, Merrick. I think that they're both long-term and short-term. I think when we recognize a problem, it's a commitment to it immediate, and then we always have to work at it. You know, being happy and healthy and living a life of happiness doesn't come without work. I mean, it just does. So we have to always look inside ourselves and out. The problems we're seeing are lack of communication, lack of understanding of who each other are, alcohol and substance abuse, divorce, physical abuse. I mean, it really runs the gamut.
So when I was... when they reached out to me to see if I might be interested in being in a conversation about becoming the rector of Christ Church, you know, I immediately had kind of an image of Greenwich, Fairfield County. And it was only when I met some of the people on the search committee, I said, these are wonderful people, you know, real substance, spiritually hungry, quality, genuine people. So what is the, you know, how do you view the perception of Greenwich versus the reality of what you see day to day?
Exactly what you just said. I think Greenwich is one of the most caring, embracing communities. Let's be real. In 1980, Kids in Crisis opened in Greenwich, Connecticut, in a community where people outside of Greenwich say they don't have any problems there. They don't care. And yet this is where we opened, and this is where we are a part of the fabric of this community. And I truly believe that we are who we are today because of the community that embraces us.
That's great. And I would just say, Sherry, you know, I've lived here in Greenwich or in the area for about 8.5 years now. And I can tell you as an outsider coming in that Kids in Crisis is a fabric of the community because of how many times I've interacted with people that have been impacted by Kids in Crisis, and so I can tell you as an outsider, it definitely is a fabric of the community. How does Kids in Crisis go about, like, what are some of the strategies or things that you do to build safe spaces for kids, and they know, and the community knows that you're a trusted place and that any kids that are in your care will have a safe space.
It all comes down to the people. Really bringing on board the right people who are there for the right reasons to take care of the kids. You don't go into the field because you're going to increase your bank account. You mm-hmm. go into it because you really care about the kids. So really finding people that are strong, passionate, culturally diverse, that really understand and are willing to learn about kids. Every day I learn something from the kids at Kids in Crisis. So I think that's what drives a lot of the staff there. Having the community at large embrace us as part of what's going on so that we can financially afford to run the programs, that we can have facilities that are safe and warm and caring. Volunteers are huge. They're very much a part of who we are, and that's important to kids. We have, for example, Greenwich Country Day does meals 3 days a week for our kids, and the kids are in awe. They're like, why do they do that? Why are they making meals for us? They don't even know us. So the lessons that are learned by kids feeling the support from somebody they've never met as a volunteer is critical.
Oh, that's great. Again, as an outsider, I know some of your staff, and they are phenomenal people.
They are.
They really are. So you mentioned that in 1980, Kids in Crisis opened up, besides it being a great year, because that was the year that I was born. How have you seen the organization change over the last 40-plus years?
You know, when I first came, I came in 80. It actually opened in 78. We were serving just Greenwich. We were serving kids had to come to us. Mm-hmm. We were very much a beds, get the kids home, short week-length stay. We have grown to be 24/7. We go out to where the kids are. We serve all of southwestern Connecticut. We have the emergency programs as a last resort. Our first resort is let's get out there and meet with this family and see what we can do to connect them. Connect them with clergy in their community that can support them. Connect them with the Boys and Girls Club that can provide after-school support and recreational opportunities. Connecting is what it's all about for us. And if we can't do that, then we offer the beds at the last alternative. Our beds are busy, but those are the kids we really feel strong about, that we were able to get them in and 90% of the time get them back home. And that's really been key. And then we stay involved with them as long as we can afterwards for up to about 3 months to make sure everything's going smoothly, because there will be bumps in the road. And that's why I say I think it's a long time commitment. There will be bumps, whether it be today or a year from now or 5 years from now. But bumps are okay because they're real. They keep us kind of rooted.
Yeah, I haven't met anybody that has the non-bumpy life.
Right. You know, somebody donated one of my favorite things at Kids in Crisis, and it's a sculpture that's on our property, and it's called Bump in the Road. And it's basically a unicycle that hits a rock in the pavement. And you could see all the things flying in the air, but they're all connected. And the unicycle in your mind can go on and on and on, and it will hit another bump in the road. But as long as we know that and know that we can survive that bump in the road, then I think we'll become stronger from it.
Wow. You know, I was having lunch last spring with Adam Rohde, the head of Greenwich Country Day, and he said that his wife helped to start a center here for counseling teens dealing with stress and anxiety. Mm-hmm. They now have 30, I believe, full-time counselors, and he said they can't keep up with the demand.
Right.
I mean, you must have 42 years at Kids in Crisis, and it's incredible. Have you seen just a morphing of stress and anxiety in the culture, and especially among teens and their families?
Absolutely. Absolutely. There's far more choices today than there was 42 years ago. There's also more of willingness to talk about it. You know, when we first opened, it was taboo to think that you needed a program like ours. And it was only going to be for those kids. And today it's for all kids. And people recognize that it can happen in any neighborhood, in any community. And that's not just cliche. That's real. Stress happens throughout our homes, throughout our communities, for a variety of reasons. And taking it head on and working with it is really what makes us stronger at the end of the day. But the problems are, choices are many more today than they were years ago.
Is this also an issue that it's the whole family issue versus it's Alex's issue? It's Alex's stress or anxiety. How do you coach families to, you know, confront it as a team rather than saying it's your daughter's issue. We'll just work with her one-on-one.
Sure, because that daughter may have the issue. She might have ADD or she may have a substance use problem, but she's still part of the family unit. So how are you as the family going to react to her? How are you going to respond to her outburst? Or how are you going to respond to her falling off the wagon? As a family unit, you're all there and you need to take a role in the workings of that family. And so everybody needs, whether you acknowledge that you're a part of the problem or not, you're part of the family. And that family has to own that problem.
And I just learned from Josh earlier today that something like 50% of all teens now want to be either a YouTube influencer or a TikTok influencer, which is incredible. Right. That's their life's goal right now. And as someone who ran her own TV show at age 16, which I think is incredible, how do you see social media feeding into all, you know, kids in crisis, kids with anxiety, stress, poor self-image, or, you know, putting all their self-images on, how many times did I get liked?
Yeah. You know, I think I laugh when I think about it, because I go back to 40 years ago. What were my grandparents saying about color TV? there's a lot of similarities to that. Although the access to and the involvement we have in social media now is both wonderful and horrible at the same time. People hide behind it. There's a lot of meanness that could come out of it. And we've seen that. And we've seen it by adults teaching kids how to do that. So I think if we can use social media to be a kinder world, we would see a lot more benefit coming from it. But I think as long as we continue to use it to do political jabs and to really go at people and not in a positive way, we're going to go down a deep, dark hole.
I worry. I've walked down the hallway here at Christ Church where our choristers often sit after school waiting for a chorister rehearsal to begin. And I have this lovely little corgi, and he was running down the hallway with me. And instead of paying attention to him and looking up or something, all three of them were sitting about 8 or 10 feet apart with their cell phone, staring into it like they were talking to the Wizard of Oz.
Yes.
And I said, "Hi, girls." No reaction. "Hey, girls, how you doing?" No reaction. "I've got Winston with me, my dog." No reaction. They were just glued to that phone. And instead of being clustered in a little pod talking and catching up, it was interacting through this. And what I find is a lot of these young people struggle with, you know, and as they get older, even as, you know, in their 20s, struggle with face-to-face, conversations.
Absolutely.
The idea of picking up a phone and calling someone in their first job is like, I want you to jump off this cliff and you have no rope.
Right, exactly. You know, we did something very similar to that. We went into the waiting room of another organization where the parents, mostly single moms, were waiting for their kids to come out of tutoring. And they were all on their phones. And they were all non-English speaking. And one of our staff went in and sat there and just observed them for the first session. And then the second time she went in, she started talking to them. And all of a sudden, she formed this group of these moms by talking to them about nutrition with their kids, about social media. And it wasn't necessarily that they didn't want to connect. They didn't know how to connect. Mm. And so having somebody be that connector made a big difference. And that group of women then became their own support group after the tutoring sessions were over. It was really fascinating. So sometimes we just have to guide people.
Yeah. And I think we're starving for personal connection.
Absolutely.
I mean, that's the way we're wired, right? And so it's not that we don't want it. It's almost that we don't know how to do it. If you ever want to see a teenager squirm, call them on a phone. They'll look at their phone like, what are you? Almost like, how dare you call me?
Absolutely.
You can text me?
Absolutely. But, it's very, very true.
Yeah, Cheryl Turkle wrote a book called In Defense of Conversation, which is fabulous. And one of the things she points out is that she learns a lot from her students, and she teaches at Columbia, was trained at Harvard and MIT, and she in both psychology and communications. She talked to one of her students who said his best friend's father just died. And so she said, or asked, what did you do to support him? And the student said, I sent him a text. She said, you didn't call or go to see him? No, he said, that would be far too invasive. So she talks about how one of the things that stood out in the book to me is she said, one of the challenges of all the time we're spending online and with these gadgets is that it's decreasing our levels of empathy. Mm-hmm. So when someone dies, it's just like a character on my Zoom meeting is no longer there, or someone in my role, you know, my contacts has been, you know, deleted.
Right.
But we're not talking a heart issue.
No.
And that's scary.
It is scary. And I think the new work world is not going to support that, because without having the face-to-face contact, I get a lot less done in the office than I work remotely. Mm-hmm. But the people contact is something I'm not willing to forego. The idle chatter around the coffee pot mm-hmm. is so important. The conversations that have nothing to do with the work I'm doing helps me to get to know my staff. But if we all start working remotely and don't come into an office, we're going to even lose more people contact. It's scary.
Maybe that's behind the great resignation. You know, if we're all just units, the only thing that matters really, how big is my paycheck
right. And
how good is my, you know, work experience? Because the heck with you all, I don't have a relationship with
right. You.
And you don't know some of the personal stuff going on in my life.
Right.
And I don't know it in yours.
Right.
How about in terms of faith, when you look through your whole journey of doing this, how has faith played a role?
I think faith is important to us in that it shapes who we are. It gives us our beliefs and our support systems and our understanding. And I take faith very, very broadly. I was brought up in the Jewish religion. I married into the Orthodox Judaism. And that was a whole new world for me. So even within my own faith, I had to learn a new part of the religion. But it helps to drive who I am as a person, because we all have to believe in something. Whatever that something is gives us hope, gives us our faith in the future. So I think faith is really critical. And it's something that we really support with the kids at work. At the shelters, making sure that if they have that connection at home. I think one of the most fabulous things for us is our Lighthouse program, our LGBTQ program, is operating at churches. Mm-hmm. And I think that's such a critical component to it, because these kids are really alienated in many ways and isolated. And for them to see the church embracing them, I think it speaks volumes to them. So here in Greenwich, coming to Christ Church is really important. In Stanford, it's at the Fish Church, the Presbyterian Church. Mm-hmm. And it's just wonderful that the physical location as well as the emotional support is there from the church.
I'm glad you brought that up, because Lighthouse has met here at Christ Church, and we've given them space to do that. We're so proud of the good work they're doing, and we've had on our banners LGBTQ plus community welcomed here at Christ Church. I've had some conservative Christians in this community ask some of our parishioners, what is that about? Like, that shouldn't be happening. And to give an idea of how valuable that is, a mother was driving by, saw that sign, mm-hmm. had a daughter in crisis who was thinking of taking, it was a daughter or son, I think it was actually her son, was thinking of self-harm and taking his life. And she saw that sign, called the church, talked to a staff member who said, we've got a Lighthouse meeting here. She got her son to the program, and her son, who had thought of taking his own life, has had a complete turnaround. But it's become a point of acceptance and helping him work through and think through things, and the whole family to do that as well. So that is one of the many great ministries you're doing.
Absolutely. I think as long as we can all be on the right side of history, will make a difference in the lives of kids. Yeah.
Well, I want to ask just two quick questions. One is, we're coming out of this pandemic. It's had a huge impact on everyone. I think it's had a huge impact on teenagers. Do you see some lasting things that we ought to be aware of that we need to address?
I think the isolation that we've talked about. If they are going out into a world that is accepting of us being by ourselves and working by ourselves and working outside of an office environment, we have to be worried about isolation.
And last question is, what is the one thing you want us to think about as we leave today that you've had a chance to share?
Kindness. I think kindness is, if we can all show kindness to each other, we'll still have bumps in the road, but we'll walk over those bumps together as opposed to by ourselves.
Ministry here at Christ Church, and of course, Merrick, great job. This has been really wonderful. And I have to say personally that I, of all the things that I think are worth giving to charitably or otherwise, that Kids in Crisis has got to be one of the most valuable charities around. So you should consider doing whatever you can to help them. And thanks for listening. We'll see you guys next week.